and then having to try and like futz with a Zoom meeting link. Like,
those kind words. Now I have 24 affinity groups, plus now we're doing the virtual conference and all the webinars. I'm telling you, it's, and we have templates, and if you don't change the templates, there are like so many different steps that we have to do now, and we're adding this database. So hopefully this will be the last time that you get three different links at the same time with three different titles.
No, Lisa, I have to tell you, like, I don't know if this is similar US Canada, but in Canada, Zoom is not approved for any of our client work. So we have to use, so we transitioned everybody over onto Microsoft Teams, which is approved. And I was giving a tutorial to the staff on how to use Teams, similar to Zoom, but not quite. Things happened in the tutorial and they said, well, what's happening right now? And I'm looking at the screen and I'm going, I have no idea. Like, all of a sudden my phone started ringing from Teams. Like, somebody from Teams was calling my phone through the meeting, but it wasn't telling me which person. So I couldn't even tell if somebody accidentally tapped a button or whatever and tell them to untap it. Like, it was.
And how long ago was that?
Last week.
Oh.
It was a disaster. It was ridiculous. And so, like, I'm sitting there and I'm going, so has anybody learned anything? And they're like, yeah, a lot. It's not working.
Yeah, I guess we all have to learn that, learn through our mistakes, how to get better.
Well, and it just is. Like, this is the reality we live in now. You can't just walk into a meeting room and start meeting.
Well, we were on a call with a vendor who was doing a formal presentation, you know, kind of pitching some work with us, and he was doing very well. And then apparently at his apartment building where he was working from home, they just decided to have a fire drill. So in the middle of the formal presentation, this fire alarm goes off that is so loud that it like freaked everyone out on the call. And he was so embarrassed. I felt so sorry for him. But we all kind of said, look, this is our life right now. At any moment, like, a child can jump over your shoulder, right, or the internet goes out, or, you know, it's just the new world we're living in.
Or a dog. My favorite is when the dog is barking so loud you can't hear anything, or a cat is walking across the screen. I mean, I've seen it all.
Yeah. Is anyone liking it any better? Or is it, how are people managing with this new reality? I mean, really, talkless, how are people managing?
Honestly, as someone who's a bit of a loner to begin with, I loved working. Like, so right now we are no longer working from home 100%, or we have very few people that are working from home. And I'm back in the office, and I'm finding that I still, like, on a very personal level, and I know that this has been the experience of a lot of people, I'm finding that I had an easier time when we were just on lockdown and we were all at home than now, where I'm kind of in the office, but I still have tons of restrictions that I have to work with, and I still have to use Zoom. And, like, so now I have all of the commonplace work stresses, and I still don't get to do all the things that I like.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you end up with this weird, like, things like, I don't get to go grocery shopping in the middle of the day anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that. I loved that I always had food.
Yeah.
Now I'm back to an empty fridge, with the exception of leftover Indian takeout. Like,
so I guess there was some good, there is something good about working from home.
Yeah, I like working from home. I feel like I'm more efficient with my time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on the food thing, I don't have to plan my food out. I can just go downstairs and get something when I'm hungry, unless I have a new puppy sleeping in my lap.
Aw, that's sweet.
And in Atlanta, not to sleep in my lap.
I've gained probably over 2 hours of my day back, because that's how long it takes me to commute 8 miles or whatever it is to my office and back. And I'm not taking my life in my hand, in my hands every time I get on I-285, which is insane. I have so loved not having to be in traffic. It's kind of great.
Wow. So people are liking it, I guess. Well, mm-hmm. the ones that have spoken so far. What about, you know, Lee or Jeff or Rachel?
Like personally or professionally?
Well, I think we're talking.
I'm interested in both.
Sounds both.
Yeah.
So I guess my answer is not that different for either one. Like we're coping. I think it's just really challenging. And for me, 6 months is the point where it almost feels weird not to be on Zoom. So like if you happen to see somebody in real life, it's like you forget what to do. Right? Like I can't remember. I was at the office. I go in very rarely. So I would say of our 120 people, probably 10 are in the office on any given day. Mm-hmm. And I had to go in to do something and I saw somebody in the hallway and I was like, I just forgot what I'm supposed to do. Like we were 6 feet away and we were both wearing masks. It was like, this doesn't feel like it's allowed. Like I'm going to go back to my office.
Yeah.
And from a service provision perspective, we're lucky probably 90% of what we were doing before, we're still doing now. Counseling, we're doing telephonically or through Zoom. The only part of our business that's down is transportation. So we were doing 30,000 door through door rides a year. And now we're probably doing 10% of that because people aren't going to non-emergency medical appointments, especially people who are elderly. And we were driving a lot of people to like adult day programs and those are canceled until further notice. Fortunately, we've been able to repurpose some of those drivers to do kosher meals on wheels deliveries. The food bank in Detroit isn't part of JFS, which don't get me started, but we volunteer to do deliveries for the kosher food bank in Detroit. So we're really lucky. We're really insulated, to be honest. Like when the economy is bad, we tend to get busier. We tend to grow. Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen the onslaught of emergency financial assistance requests that we expected. So we spent about $1 million a year on emergency financial assistance. And we expected those requests to come in. And I think like everybody else, we can speculate with the best of them. We thought, okay, fine. The unemployment subsidy will get people through July, but then we'll really start to see it in August. No. And we certainly saw an uptick, but I would say nowhere near the magnitude we expected. And our federation raised some $8 million in its COVID emergency campaign. And it's only distributed a million or two of that.
Well, you'll need it. You'll need it going forward.
Right. It's next year, the year after, the year after that. Yeah. So Faye asked who funds the emergency assistance. So a chunk of it is funded by our federation. A chunk of it is funded, at least this year because of COVID, by United Way. And a chunk of it is funded through donor funds. But those are the dollars that actually are least often earmarked. And they're really easy to fundraise for. So again, the JFS, different than the JVS or even the JCC, which I know we don't have JCCs in our association, but like, hey, can you donate some money such and such, like Lisa's about to be evicted or Carl's going to have his heat turned off. That's an easy call to make. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of like pinching ourselves, to be honest, because we see what other employers are doing. In fact, the JCC, which is literally across the street from us in Detroit, they closed their health club, so they're going to have to eliminate a lot of positions. Almost everybody's furloughed. We furloughed a handful of people, but brought them back.
Oh, you brought them back.
It's really surreal, to be honest. Like we're very fortunate that we've never had more money in the bank, and we've never been as financially healthy and sound as we are right now. So we're just waiting for the other shoe to drop. And Lisa, to your point, you know, we're still dealing with the reverberations of 2008, 2009. So I expect that this is going to have a really long tail. And when people have forgotten all about COVID in 3 years, when somebody who is displaced from a job can't get back into the labor force, we are going to have to spend some of those dollars.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Quick question. So are all the, and again, totally ignorant Canadian question, are all the federal subsidies done now?
No.
All the federal programs for
definitely not all, but like the big one that people were really enjoying, that $600 a week unemployment benefit from the federal government to supplement what each of the 50 states do individually, that's gone. There are some smaller programs, but our government is totally gridlocked and they can't agree right. on the next version of support. But if you listen to the Treasury Secretary and the Speaker of the House, it sounds like that might change pretty soon.
And we don't really have this very much, but there's a number of agencies I've talked with that money took so long from the first CARES Act, the only one sadly so far, and all the money has to be sent by December 31st. Mm-hmm. So there is a ton of pressure on agencies now to have to use the money up when they could have used it earlier, and they don't, or they won't need to spend it quite yet, and they have to spend it or lose it by December 31st. So great that there was the first one, definitely need a second one in a lot of other ways. Mm-hmm. And yet the first one is still sort of trickling through and in some cases flooding agencies who are trying to give it away for housing and other kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I would say if you inserted Minneapolis for Detroit, you could pretty much say just about everything Jeff said, and we're in about the same situation. You could change some of the dollars here or there, the amounts. We don't give away nearly as much emergency assistance as you described, but it is sort of the same where, you know, a little bit of an increase, but we haven't seen a huge flood yet. We got extra money. We haven't spent it all. The development people are worried that the donors are going to feel like, you know, why did we give you that money if you can't spend it? And we have been messaging from the beginning, this is going to be a gradual increase for months and years, not, you know, all the same things. Maybe the only thing I would add that looks different, and it's probably not different, it's just a matter of it didn't come up, and structurally you have different. So for us, because workforce is part of JFCS, we don't have a separate agency. That's an area where we've already gotten an increase in funding. We've already been told we have to take more clients. We're hiring more people. That's not true in terms of vocational rehabilitation, because most of our clients with significant disabilities are choosing not to engage in work or searching for work related to their disabilities or other things. So that's actually kind of turned upside down. But in terms of dislocated worker, in terms of it's a Minnesota Family Investment, which is, you know, people on support. Those are, you know, we're getting more clients than we can possibly take at the moment until we hire people, and we're trying to hire as fast as we can.
Yeah, in Houston, it's interesting. Our disability work program, where we, you know, hire folks with disabilities to run some businesses for us, they're getting new clients like every single day because so many of the other programs in town have shut down. And even though we had to go remote for a period of time and now we're kind of back to partial on site, we were one of the only programs not to shut down. So people who were getting all these brand new clients who never had used JFS before, who are reaching out because they're hearing through the grapevine that we're open. The difference we experienced here, maybe from what, you know, we and Jeff were saying as far as financial aid, is that because of our experience with all the floods, the city came to us to distribute some of the money that they had allocated that was really unrelated to JFS or our clients. So they wanted us to distribute on their behalf $1 million like in 30 days. So that they wanted just to give it to someone with the proven infrastructure to do it. So we kind of had to lay that on top of what we were already doing. And the advantage to us in doing it was that for any of the clients who were typical JFS clients, if they qualified for those funds, we got to spend those funds first and save some of the Federation dollars for later. So we felt like it, you know, it was kind of a trade-off, but it was a lot of money to get out the door really fast. So I think our case managers and our finance team are glad that we're done with it for right now.
Well, maybe I'll just ask the question that I put in there. And the other thing I'll mention that maybe, I don't know if it's the same for other people, but similarly to Detroit, you know, we're feeling very financially sound. And that's great. And most of that we can see relatively well into the future, but where we're definitely at risk is the government contracts. You know, I'm sure your states are required to balance their budget. And if there isn't another round from the feds and it doesn't, or if there is a round that doesn't go to state and local government, those effects for us are going to be gigantic, because we have a lot of contracts with the state, with the county, with the city of Minneapolis, primarily for workforce and mental health. And depending on what happens in November, that's going to have a huge impact. So if there's money from the feds, and if the Democrats take the second house, because we're the only split legislature in the country, if that doesn't change, then I'm sure there'll be a lot of pressure and we'll lose government contracts or have reductions in those, or at least that's very possible. And, you know, a lot of those are renewed January or June. So that will be a thing there. On financial assistance, our policy has been that you can be eligible for assistance, and then there's details for what you're using it for, all the same things I'm sure you have, but the original qualifier is that you're either a client or participant in one of our programs, or if you're not a client or participant, but you are you're Jewish in the Jewish community locally, either one of those gets you in the door to then look at, you know, what's your situation, what do you need it for, what's your plan, and so on. Because we have more than we can spend right now, we're sort of asking that question as to whether we should broaden that in any particular way, where we could serve more people who are in need, but not end up in a situation where all of a sudden every agency is saying, oh, JFCS has money from anybody in any situation, you should go to them. And I'm just wondering if others deal with that differently.
Has anybody done like, and I'm asking this question because I'm in the process of putting together this little survey for staff, but it's almost like a financial wellness check, like asking the workers about their interpretation or their impressions of their clients' overall financial health right now, only because, and I'm not sure if this is the case with a lot of other agencies, but we find that a lot of our financial assistance clients tend to come from other program areas within our organization. We don't have a lot of people who just come to us for financial assistance. It's usually somebody from one of the other programs. So anyway, we're trying to at least somehow put a
thumb in the wind to see. Quick assessment that we use sometimes called the financial capability scale or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's very quick and easy to do, and it might give you a measure of who's most at risk, but I can't remember how many questions, but it's something like 10. It's not a huge number. And it's like, how likely are you to, you know, if an emergency came up that you would have money to pay for it? I mean, it's very simple questions, but you know, it has been validated, and it kind of tracks over time, you know, as people's situation get better or worse. And it might be an easy thing that would standardize that assessment, you know, and give you kind of an overview of who's most at risk.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I can try to find a copy of it and send it to you.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
You know, Lee, I was thinking about what you were asking about financial assistance. When we're not in a community disaster, which almost never happens now, but like under normal circumstances, it's sort of very much the same. I mean, our money is mostly for people who are connected to the Jewish community, however you define it. Every time there's a community-wide disaster, like a flood or, you know, COVID, we have always sought to find some money that is for the broader community, because we never wanted the message in Houston at a time of disaster to be that we are turning people away. So we have certain funders who like to fund sort of the extension of services beyond the Jewish community, and we tend to reach out to kind of those areas or look for, you know, city or county or other funds that we can, you know, try to appear that we're being a little bit more open than we are, you know, when it's not a whole community-wide disaster.
What do other
agencies
do? Yeah, sorry.
No, that's helpful. And I'd be curious if others have similar things. It's, you know, the second, our, you know, many programs, we have almost no Jewish clients. And overall, it's about 60% Jewish and 40% not. So there's many people who receive it because they're in any one of the programs. It's just, if we, I don't know, maybe everyone else is in the same situation where there isn't that much extra need that's being met, or maybe if we were to somehow tap into other parts of the community, I don't know.
So what we did in Detroit is sometimes we change our criteria. So let's say in normal times, it's 200% of the poverty line to be considered. We started doing a Passover food assistance program a couple years ago where we, I think, changed it to 250%. And then this year in particular, we started a high holiday food assistance program and we opened that up to non-clients. So normally to get a financial assistance check, and people don't get it, it's always the vendor. So we write the check to your mortgage company or utility company, blah, blah, blah. For high holiday assistance, we changed that requirement. So we were giving that money out to people who weren't clients. And Yulia just joined a few minutes ago. She's the chief program officer for older adult services. So I don't know how different that story is in the elderly community. I know for our family support services, that made a big difference because mm-hmm. a lot of the families who come to us for emergency financial assistance, which tends to be in the form of food vouchers, which don't ask me why we give out food vouchers when there's a kosher food bank. Like I said, don't get me started. But a lot of those families are Orthodox. So the family size is very large. And those food vouchers are critical to those families making it each month. But Yulia, if you want to talk what's happening with older adults around that non-client assistance.
I mean, not much happening yet. We opened it up. A lot of the people calling us are not older adults. Like Jeff said, mostly families right now. Particularly in around the holiday time when there are high expenses. And we expanded actually to, I'm trying to remember if it's 250 or 300 even, maybe 250, you were right, for the emergency financial assistance, we kept it that way. But for older adults, you know, I'm not necessarily thinking we will have a lot of clients who want just that. Because people generally tend to need home care, meals, whatever, when they call us. I don't think we will have a huge influx of people who just want a food voucher.
The other reason we're lucky, in air quotes, is that we don't have any government contracts. So our uncertainty around state budgets is through one very large grant from the state of Michigan called the Multicultural Integration Funding Grant. And that's actually sort of stewarded by Federation. And there are, I don't know, Yulia, 8, 9 different agencies, some Jewish, some not, for whom Federation quarterbacks that money. And we heard preliminarily, of course, the state's budget year starts October 1st. We heard for this year we'll be whole. And that's a big chunk of money for us. It's about $1.3 million. But we're lucky that we're not relying on a lot of contracts. But our big worry, so the flip side of all this good fortune is that probably, you know, all considered cash and prizes from Federation, you're talking almost $5 million a year. And the majority of that money comes from donors. So when the stock market was down 35% in 6 weeks, mm-hmm. things were looking a little hairy. Fortunately, the average donor to Federation today, their IRA or 401k or whatever they've got, they're probably in fine shape. And the philanthropy has been there. But if Federation were to see a significant downturn in its campaign, that's where we would really be impacted differently than some other places where Federation is a much smaller part of their business.
But everyone has that, you know, something that they have to worry about, whether it's Federation or government contracts or, you know, large donors. And it's
anybody, has anybody made a decision about, and I don't know how this normally plays out, but about pay increase in the future? We normally do an increase across the board in January if we can. Now would be the time of year we normally tell staff. I'm just wondering what we've gotten a few survey info. I've been able to gather a few things, but anybody dealing with that yet?
We're just starting to kind of lay out the budget, you know, projections and meeting with all the department heads. So, you know, generally what we do, probably similar to what you do, is we kind of look at how the budget looks and then we go and get an amount approved by the, you know, the personnel committee of the board. And then we you know, we distribute it however we see fit based on performance and other things like that. So we'll know better, you know, probably in 2 or 3 weeks, whether it looks like we can find money for it or not. But I mean, it's our intention that if we can, that we'll give something. But we just have to see how the budget kind of plays out once we start getting real numbers in there.
And do you find that are a majority of your staff well within market range, like their salaries are well within market range? I ask because our tradition for at least the last, I think it would be the last 6 years or so with my organization, and certainly since I arrived, they do a 3% basically guaranteed increase every year because they're trying to catch them up to market value, because a lot of the positions just weren't sitting at that level yet. Now we seem to be fairly leveled off, although our province or our region was subject to wage freezes for the last three years.
Wow.
And so this year we did, instead of the, you know, 3%, we did it ended up being close to 4.2% increase. And then that was the best that we could do. And then we'll start again with the performance-based increases at a later date. But at this point, we kind of figured, A, they hadn't been getting their standard raises anyway. And on top of that, with the stress and the adaptation and all this kind of stuff, we kind of sat there saying, you know, performance evals this year are not going to be like the measurements are going to be weird anyway. So doing it based on performance is not going to be as, we felt not as beneficial this year.
We're sort of in a transition. Our previous CFO really just liked to give across the board, like figure out the number and just give it to everybody. And that wasn't really very effective at retaining people or other things. And as he was transitioning out and we kind of brought in some kind of new thinking, what we did last year is we did a market survey, and then we took the dollars that the board allocated and, you know, took care of first the people who are way off of market who we wanted to attract, and then spread the rest based on performance. And so I think now we're in pretty good shape, where I think most people are sort of within what the market, you know, they should be. And I think this year we're going to try to do the same, kind of look at where we are to market and make some adjustments as needed if there's dollars to do it, and then give the rest based on merit. Because there were some, we found last year when we did our very first real comprehensive professional kind of market assessment, that there were some really key positions that were so far off market that we were going to lose them if we didn't address it quickly. So we just had to do it. I think this year there aren't as many outliers as there used to be.
Do you think,
Carl, how do you develop the methodology to distribute that merit-based component? So the board says here's X thousand dollars. How does the management team figure out how to give that out?
So, you know, what let's say the raise, you know, the average is supposed to come out to 3% or something like that. We'll let the manager or director of a department, we'll say that your budget for your department, you know, for raises is 3%, but you need to distribute it based on the performance review. So if somebody is, you know, at an unacceptable level, or they're like, you know, being this close to being terminated for performance, they don't get anything. But then, you know, and so they, you know, and then once they submit their recommendations, usually, you know, our C-suite team will sit down and look at it and just, you know, make sure that it makes sense and that they didn't just give all the raises to their friends or, you know, like whatever, you know, that Sure. It made sense based on what we knew about things. And then we make some final adjustments and, you know, that kind of thing. But so far, I mean, you know, the last couple of years that we've been trying to do this, I think the department heads overall were pretty responsible in, you know, the recommendations that they made. So it was a good learning experience for them.
Rachel, did you want to say something about this?
Sure. It's hard to imagine we're going to be able to do raises, but I really hope so. We're part of our federation here, and the federation is making a lot of cuts with program staff, and they're really under a microscope right now in the community, especially with all the dollars they recently raised for emergency assistance. And people are having trouble understanding why there's still money being invested in programming and other things that aren't direct assistance. So it's hard to say what's going to be. And it's in this situation, it's hard to be part of the Federation when you're doing social services, because we're looped into that category when our staff are the only ones on campus coming here every day, serving the community. And, you know, you want to be able to honor them and do something to support them and show that you recognize that they've been doing this day after day since March 12th when everyone else shut down. But it's hard because we don't really have that choice to make internally anymore. It's now being really looked at from the lay leadership.
Rachel, did you do you know if the Federation got money from JFNA? There was this money very specifically allocated for social services, which should have then come to you?
Yes. So that's for the annual campaign, the match. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah. So they're working on that. They have until December to raise that money. The level that they're at would essentially give us the same allocation that we got this year through Federation. But the way our allocation works is we have to actually submit budget for each program area, and they decide how to allocate it by program. So we don't just get to use it where we see fit or how we strategize. And they're also talking about not giving us the answer until June of next year. So we're starting to get worried about our 2021 budget. We're in a great financial situation today. We've made a lot of important cuts that should have been done a while ago. And, you know, we were kind of forced to make those tough decisions because of COVID. We got a lot of new grant funding that we never had before, a lot of new donors we never had before, which is great, but they all want to fund direct service right now. So we're worried about next year.
So I wanted to just take a moment. Thanks for telling us that. I think everyone agrees with you, Rachel. I don't, you know, everyone's nodding. Karen Corkin is just on. Hello there, Karen. And she is the new COO of JCFS Chicago. So I didn't know if you wanted to introduce yourself, say anything, you know.
So it's nice to meet all of you. I apologize that I'm the first time I'm meeting you. It's halfway through your meeting. I'm new to the organization and new to these meetings, and have heard from Stacy, who many of you probably already know, that she always found them to be really worthwhile and a great community to be a part of. So I'm looking forward to filling her shoes in that capacity and working with all of you going forward.
Terrific. Welcome.
Thanks.
So we're just talking about next year and money, of course, and you know, the fear of not having it. So Carl, I didn't know if you had other, and I didn't know if anyone else wanted to talk about that, Linda or Laura, but you had all sorts of ideas that you wanted to talk about at this meeting. I write Carl because he's the, you know, chair of
this group. And I think that sort of came up recently here, and I was just, you know, if anyone's interested in talking about it, is during the 2016 election, after that, you know, it was before I came to JFS, but what I've been told is, like, people were so devastated by the results of the election that there were people who felt like they couldn't come into work, you know, that they were that upset. And then we also had a lot of therapists in particular where their clients were expressing very strong opinions that they found kind of threatening or offensive during their therapy session. So we had a discussion this morning at our all staff meeting about, you know, was there anything that we could do to help prepare our staff, but also support our community during a very, you know, difficult election cycle emotionally for a lot of people, you know, where it might not even be resolved, you know, for a little while. And it was amazing. We broke out into, you know, to small groups, you know, via Zoom for breakout rooms. And we had a substantial number of our staff who talked about feeling unsafe to even go to the polls, and that they were creating safety plans and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And one of the suggestions that came up is some of our staff wanted our board chair and our CEO to issue a public statement at some point about what our position was related to this kind of environment. And I didn't know, like, if each of your agencies had, well, if you had talked about the election at all and doing anything, but in general about public statements, if you had a policy about how you issue them and when you issue them and who gets to decide and is your board involved and, you know, all that. Because, you know, we want to, you know, kind of stay in our lane and not, you know, take political sides. But, you know, after George Floyd and other things, there was a sense of needing to say something publicly. So I don't know if anyone has an interest, but that's been on our mind a lot here in Houston.
We're doing just a couple of things in Detroit. First of all, just informing people about deadlines and needing to register, vote early, things like that. We have a Jewish Relation Communal Council, Jewish Community Relation Council in Detroit. So we're basically adopting their information and posting it on our website and social media. We will be sending a flyer to all of our clients, either via email or those who don't have emails via mail. And then the last thing we talked about at this point was giving people a free ride if they want to drop off their ballot prior to the election day. Not doing it on, we as an agency decided to be closed on election day, just to give people additional time and acknowledge that when we're not closed as an agency, then everybody's kind of on, even when they're on ETO. So we chose to close a few extra days this year. This fall, and we will be actually for the first time ever closed between Christmas and New Year's, but that's a whole different conversation. But for voting, so anybody, whether they are client or not, any community member can request a free ride to drop off the ballot, basically.
That's really nice. Wow. Yeah, I don't know if you guys have heard, but the governor of Texas decided to create only one drop-off location per county. And Harris County, which is essentially the city of Houston, which is sort of the geographic size of Rhode Island, now has one drop-off site for the entire county. So people are really freaking out here a lot. So.
Well, what you had brought up, sorry, Lee, and then I thought what you had really were saying is, are you talking with your staff about how they're talking with clients? I mean, is that also a fear? Not just getting the ballots in, but then what happens after and what's happening before? I don't know if that was something you were talking about.
What we were talking about here? I mean, that's certainly a worry among our staff, you know, so.
I think it's a worry among, I'm sure, many staff. Anyway, Lee, what were you gonna say? I'm sorry.
No, I mean, we're definitely doing voter outreach in a variety of ways, which is certainly nonpartisan and so on. You know, we have a food shelf that's in the same building we are. While most of our staff are not in the building, they are. And we actually have volunteers and staff from our agency in the parking lot there to connect with people, help them, all those sorts of things, and social media and things like that. We spend a lot of time regularly talking about staff and how they're doing with mental health and other things generally. Certainly the election is a part of that, but we haven't really talked about as we get closer to that day or the aftermath or this sort of thing. Public statement wise, I think we've tried to refine our approach over the last 5 or 6 years to sort of at least have an idea every time something comes up. You know, whether it's a tragedy on the scale of, you know, Pittsburgh or, you know, Pulse nightclub or things like that. And then sort of this kind of thing. And our first question is this issue something that has a significant impact on some particular stakeholders of this agency? So, if the answer to that is no, then there's no statement. If the answer to that is yes, then we still consider, why would we make the statement? Is it internally to support staff? Is it externally for community sake and whatnot? Most situations, the statement is made by, you know, the CEO, and it can be made publicly and certainly sign on to different advocacy kinds of things. We typically just do that. Occasionally, We'll go to our, we actually have a volunteer advocacy committee that's become very active over the last few years. And we actually have two other agencies in it with us. We'll sometimes go to them. And then if we really feel like it would be better for the board president and the CEO to make a statement, you know, then we'll run it through the board or that kind of thing. So that's typically, I would say, it came up very recently because President Trump is very, very determined to win Minnesota. Minnesota hasn't voted for Republican in presidential election, I think since 1960 or something like that. It was closer than it's been in many, many years last election. So he's been here quite a lot. He's been here twice in the last 3 weeks. And we have a very large Somali community. And as you may be aware, a lightning rod for him is Ilhan Omar, who is the congressperson for the district I live in. And Ilhan Omar is Somali. So in each of his last two visits, the president has very aggressively talked about what he describes as a very negative impact and dangerous impact on Somali people in the state of Minnesota. And he has said what he will do to prevent, you know, refugees and immigrants from ruining our state, and specifically about people in the Somali community. So that is factual. That is not political spin. And we as an agency that was founded by immigrants for immigrants and refugees and continues to serve a lot of immigrants and refugees, we have a Somali staff. We serve a lot of people who are Somali. Asked the question, should we be making a statement? And we did in one of Judy's weekly emails, each of us, Judy, the CEO, and I each send a weekly email to the staff only during COVID. We didn't used to do it that way. And she did mention it as a support to our staff in the Somali community. We thought externally it would be JCRC. Yulia mentioned JCRC in Detroit, and that would be right up their alley. So we reached out to them and the National Council of Jewish Women in Minnesota, thinking that three of us would be appropriate to make a statement, maybe not even mentioning President Trump, but saying that, we reject the claims and, the disparagement of people in the Somali community and their, strong contributors, and this is what they do, and this is where they bring value, and they're really important people, and we stamp all those sorts of things. And JCRC, actually, in this instance, chose not to make a statement. And their explanation to me was that they are anticipating that in the days before and right after the election, that they may have to make very important public statements to try to maintain order and confidence in the election process, which is just a bizarre thought, but I get it. And their concern was if they made statements now, particularly if they were seen as partisan, that there would be less merit and strength to their statements later. So it's sort of cranking through those sorts of weird things. And there were some who advised us that because we are lobbying at the Capitol right now for an increase in funding for a program, happens to be a program that about 70% of the people are East African immigrants, many from Somalia, that if we made a statement, we might poison ourselves in terms of people at the Capitol. I mean, to me, that's a terrible thought, that if we spoke up on behalf of people, that other people would defund us. But those are real questions that we're wrestling with.
Yeah, at the local Holocaust Museum where I'm on the board, we created a process about 4 years ago, where we actually have a public statement committee that's made up of members of the board. So anytime we feel that there's a need, the staff usually write it, but then it goes out to the public statement. Well, the board chair first reviews it with the CEO, and then it goes out to the committee for review and for a vote. And the thought there was that we didn't want to leave any one person, the CEO or the board chair, hanging. And so if we send it to a diverse committee and they, sort of looked at it, we would hopefully keep ourselves out of, most of the political landmines by getting, and so far, I think it's worked pretty well as a process. But it's a different type of organization, obviously, than a JFS. So, we, you know, we've just been struggling as there's, you know, all this kind of stuff keeps bubbling up. The staff really want us to have more of a voice, and we're trying to find out what's the appropriate kind of lane to be in as a JFS, where we're speaking out when we should, but kind of staying out of things that are really not our business, you know. So I was just curious what other folks were doing.
One thing I can share that we're doing here for the first time is, and we frame this in a communication. I'm hearing an echo. Are you hearing my voice?
You just muted.
I'll put it in the chat so I'm not echoing.
We can hear you now.
But you can hear me now, okay. So we are, as a way to encourage civic engagement, and of course, nonpartisan, and we framed it sort of in the spirit or in the memory or legacy of both John Lewis and Justice Ginsburg around participation in democracy and in our government, really to improve lives of and opportunities for people across the country. We are, for the first time, and are committing to doing it with every president, every 4 years when there's a presidential election. We might decide to do this more often, but wanted to start there. Giving people a paid day between that we announced this back on the last week and November 3rd to take a day to engage civically in any way that spoke to them. They just, we obviously work through legal and HR to make sure, like, all of sort of crossing our T's on how to do this, but are excited because really it's optional, but really you just, we're asking people present or let their supervisor know what they're going to be doing, and then they could pick a day between, you know, when we announce it November 3rd to have time away from the office that was paid in support of sort of promoting civic engagement across our staff. So that's one thing we're doing differently this year.
We did something kind of in the same spirit, but a little differently, where Martin Luther King's birthday had never been a holiday that we closed. And so this year we went to the board and asked their permission to add that to one of our holidays. And so, and the idea, we're allowing our sort of diversity committee to kind of work on the details, but the idea was that it would be a day of service, that we would encourage, you know, people either individually or as a group from JFS to go out and do some community service as a way of sort of honoring that legacy, you know, that, you know, we would either as a whole agency go do some volunteer activities together, or people could choose something that was meaningful for them. But rather than just give people a day to kind of sit at home, you know, we felt like we had enough of those sort of days, that maybe what we were missing in our culture was sort of a day where we go out and support the larger community.
It's a great idea.
And that would help us be visible in the community as well. So
absolutely. Love that.
So next year will be the first, you know, the first year that that's fully in swing.
Carl, this is Laura. We did that for years, probably for 10 years. And then we just switched last year to taking the day. So, you know, maybe these things just evolve, you know, over time. But we went out into the community and then also had projects within the agency that we did. And I think people have liked both options. So who knows, maybe in 10 years we'll switch back. But we did have success with that for a good period of time.
Well, nothing lasts forever, so.
Right.
Even a few years of community service out of them, that'll be great. We'll call it a win.
Right.
Oh, Shane has to leave. Okay.
Anyway.
So I can't even remember who asked the question about raises, but did you feel like you got enough answers?
Whoever asked, well, I asked the question, and yeah, that's helpful. I mean, I think,
I just can't.
We don't do merit increases.
Getting a raise this year.
What's that?
I just can't think. I can't believe anyone thinks they would be getting a raise this year.
Well, you know, I'll say a couple things about that. I mean, one, as we talked about earlier, you know, we are in a pretty strong financial position, especially with, you know, even if you go back to the Paycheck Protection Act money, when we were operating throughout, and a lot of those things were already paid for, so that, you know, helped. And you know, we are hiring people who are jumping from other jobs to these jobs, and not necessarily just people who don't have jobs. People are moving around definitely in terms of employment and getting some for salary reasons. So I think it really kind of depends.
Well,
but we aren't sure what people are expecting. That's definitely a question.
Well, the reason I say that is I know you're flush now, but you may not be flush moving forward. Everyone's so worried about the uncertainty. And when you give someone a raise, then the following year you have to, you know, give that and a little bit more so that you're.
Yeah, I think someone asked the question about, you know, market. And I think Shanna was asking the question before she jumped off, and that they've been behind, so they're trying to catch up. And we, 4 and 5 years ago, made a big adjustment to try to get people up to the what we think is the 50th percentile in the market. We still actively look at that. We regularly review individual positions or positions across and try to maintain it. And if you go a year without raises, it's pretty easy to start falling off of that pace. And in some ways, if we can afford to do it January 1st, I think our feeling is we don't know if the other shoe is going to drop next year. So let's raise now. And then if we have to, you know, not do a raise next year, we would just not do a raise or something like that. But we've typically been at about 2.5%. And there was quite a bit of data out there that, you know, in a lot of industries, a lot of spaces, a lot of size businesses, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 was what many employers were expecting to do. And that's probably where we'll come out, and we probably will do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one thing,
we have both of those dynamics going. So we started our market survey, which we hadn't done probably in 5 years, in February. So we got the results in the middle of the pandemic, and we're like, you know, it's one thing to not know, but once you know, what do you do about it? So over the course of this calendar year, we brought everyone who fell outside the range for their particular position, we brought up to the minimum. So now we can say that everybody in the agency earns at least the minimum for his, her, their range. And you can argue about, is that the right range, is that the right title? But we have to take something as the gospel. And we think we did a good job with gathering that data. So what we're doing at the end of this year, and we talked about performance reviews. So we're still doing performance reviews, and the performance reviews will guide the raises, which we expect to do. And we're going to try, now that everyone's at least at the minimum, we're going to take this year's performance reviews and look at the medians. And based on performance reviews, we're going to see who needs to move up a little bit, who needs to move up a lot, and potentially who needs to not move at all. And like, it's a multi-year process for Shanna, same thing for us. Let's imagine that somebody's 16% away from their median. That's not going to happen at once, but they might get a 4% raise. So I think similarly, it's strange that we're going to give people more than their usual 2 or 3% raise. We usually do a 2% raise and a 1% bonus, but we're also looking for more inventive ways to distribute that bonus, which is why I asked Carl, like, I believe that some people shouldn't get a bonus and a few people should get a big bonus, like 10%, something really meaningful. And then separately, because we got this windfall, like Lee described, we decided very modest amount, but we're going to give every employee a $500 bonus just as a thanks and recognition of, like, this is craziness that we're living through. And everyone has had to go above and beyond and work with kids and cats and dogs and lions and tigers and bears.
Oh my.
Exactly. So I think for us, I'm hoping that starting January 1st, even more people will be closer to their median. And I think one thing we haven't done very well, which I want to do better, is compensation, in my view, needs to be a signaling mechanism. Right. And where there isn't dispersion, it's hard to signal. So I want somebody to not get a raise and to have a mediocre performance review And in that way, we can coach people out. Not that we don't coach people out, but to me, it's just one more arrow in the quiver.
We found it worked really well. The few people who didn't get raises were really motivated. And so in one particular situation, the conversation was, is there anything that I can do to overcome this? And the supervisor, you know, talked to me, we set up a plan, we told her person that we would reevaluate, I think in 6 months. And she actually knocked it out of the park and met every single goal. And so then we gave her a raise kind of middle of the year, like to acknowledge the hard work, you know, but we didn't make it retroactive because right. That was a period of time of no performance, you know. And then other people decided they didn't want to be held accountable and left or whatever. But it worked really well to say, no, you know, that performance doesn't merit an increase. You're not meeting expectations.
I'm really excited about our ability to transform the entire life cycle of the performance review and the compensation from just this, like, everyone just going through the motions to it actually can reward performance, but also incentivize changes.
Right. The part we have to do next is we don't have really firm ranges. And I'm more concerned about the top of the range than the bottom of the range so much. But we need to get to a point where we're not continuing to give people raises when they're at the max.
Right.
Because I mean, we could give them a one-time bonus, but I don't want it to accrue to their base salary because I don't want it to encroach on, you know, like have the gap between different levels disappear. And also we do matching on contributions for retirement and other kinds of things. And so if it goes to their base, then I'm paying more and more, not just salary, but in benefits. So that's the next piece of our work in the benchmarking is looking at what are the salary ranges for each.
And I liked what you said about like the merit pay being decided by the department director. So one of the things that we'll do this year, I want the department directors to look at all their performance reviews and the ranges for all those positions and say, okay, how does this case manager compare to that one? And this person's at the 47th percentile and this one's at the 52nd percentile. Do the performance reviews agree with that? Does your overall impression of the work that they do agree with that? Because I think it's just been a long time since we looked at this very seriously. And I think we have issues of equity across departments, but also within departments.
Yeah.
People joined, did they join from outside? Did they get promoted? Blah, blah, blah.
Right. Yeah.
So I had one thing to say that we don't have time for, but Cindy, hello. I'm glad that you made it on for the last 2 minutes, better late than never. Good to see everyone's face. Shana Tova to all. But I wanted to say, I wondered if people are compensating their staff for working from home with their phones and Wi-Fi and all of that kind of stuff. I wonder if people are doing that. Okay, so it looks like people are not. And the last thing is don't forget
We gave premiums to people. We talked about like at least one time and we talked about maybe a second one, $50 each. No, it's like a $50 one-time premium for using their stuff at home and buying whatever else they need. But we do reimburse, we either reimburse people's working on cell phone or we give them a GFS cell phone. So if they're not using GFS cell phone, we pay for their cell phone like $45 a month or something like that. So 46.
So I was just
our only exception to that is that we have a couple of staff who it became clear at some point that they did not have reliable Wi-Fi at home and they could not work productively. And so we are sort of handling that on a case-by-case basis to figure out what the situation is and giving them assistance with that.
But not for just people who have Wi-Fi. So you're not giving a stipend each month for your staff who are using their own Wi-Fi, using their own phones.
No.
Okay. No.
Ruben wanted to find out what people are doing. Yes, what? Carl?
Well, we didn't provide any stipends, but, you know, like we had to provide Zoom licenses for everyone that were HIPAA compliant to use compliant. We said to them, look, after the end of the business day, there's no additional cost to us for you to use this to stay in touch with your family or friends, or feel free to use it. You know, we already made the investment. And So people really like that because they didn't have to get their own license and they could have big family get-togethers and not worry.
Like on the 45 minutes, right. That's a gift.
40 minutes and like two people. This way they could have their Seder or do whatever they wanted and have 25 people on the call. And, you know, we tried to sort of like be flexible on the things that we could be flexible on.
Right. Terrific. And the only other thing I wanted to say is that October 15th, I hope you all can come to the Bring Your Own gathering, right, of executives. Carl is the co-chair of that networking executives forum. It's going to be a lot of fun. You're really going to get to know everyone in a different way. We've made sure of that. So we hope that you put that on your calendars, October 15th from 5 to 6:30 Eastern. Okay, so whatever that is for everyone. And our next meeting is November 16th. Mm-hmm. And we still have all the issues that we didn't talk about today. We can talk about them.
Cindy, when's your birthday?
Whose birthday?
Cindy said it's her birthday coming up.
On the 16th? We can't hear you.
There, I got it off. On the 15th. So all the execs will have to sing happy birthday to me.
Oh, certainly we'll make that. Well, I'll write that down so we can remember to at least say happy birthday. If we don't sing it, we'll certainly say it.
Did you record this by chance?
Yes.
Lisa, okay. I'll catch up. Sorry, I'm the doctor. So
Lisa, I sent you an email about transportation as multiple people were interested. So maybe you're interested.
Can you be on that transportation call we had last month? There were like 45 people on that call. It's so funny. So that's also in the library, the resource library, but we could do it with just you COOs if you want to do a little call like that too. Okay. Sure. Sounds good.
Thank you.
Anything you want to say, Carl? Any words of wisdom?
Pardon me?
Stay safe. Vote early.
Vote early and often.
Yeah, vote early, not often.
Bye, mail. Oh, yeah.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Thank you.
Yeah, bye.